Has anybody here ever seen, I'm sure you have seen these videos, whether you've seen them online or you've seen them on the news or you've seen them through some other outlet, videos of a soldier's reunion with their family, right? You've probably seen them on commercials. I see them online a lot, of family unsuspecting, not realizing, and their loved, whether it's their husband or their wife or their mother or their father, they show up and everybody's all surprised and they have these big warm embraces, and it's something that just kind of warms the heart. I think that the most emotionless person, when they see those videos, can't help but feel some sense of joy at seeing that reunification. Even if it wasn't a surprise, just seeing soldiers coming off of their bus or off of a ship, you know, sailors off the ship or whatever it is, getting off of the plane, but then seeing that reunification that takes place, it tugs on the heartstrings, I think, if we're all honest with each other. It's funny, whenever one's on TV, if Caitlin and I are sitting in the living room watching it on TV, every single time she gets tears in her eyes. She can't watch one of those videos without getting a little bit emotional. And I think a lot of that has to do with her and I's experience. I mean, she and I experienced that reunification when I returned home from my deployment to Iraq. So I think that is a very personal thing for her when she gets to see others experiencing the same joy that she experienced whenever I came home. But even if we haven't experienced that, even if maybe you yourself have never been in a situation where you've had a loved one, whether it's a child or a sibling or a spouse or a parent, come home from something like that, I think all of us get emotionally connected to that, because wired within us, I think, is this desire for a happily ever after, right? This desire that we want things to work out. There's a reason why when we watch movies and TV shows or read stories, there's a reason that the vast majority of them have resolution to the conflict at some point, right? There's usually some happy ending, and not every movie. There are some movies that at the end of them, you're like, well, that was a waste of 2 hours of my life. But for the most part, movies that are made and things that we consume when it comes to entertainment, we like them because at the end we feel good, right? They leave us with this sense of resolution, that the story, the conflict has resolved itself. Nobody really enjoys a movie where at the end of it, everyone's lives are a complete train wreck or everybody dies and everybody's miserable and then the credits start rolling. Most of us would not enjoy a movie like that. But Caitlin and I, we're no different. You know, we feel the same way. And when I returned home from being away for over a year, we could not wait for that happy ending, right? That moment where I would get to see her and she would get to see me. I'd been gone for 15 months. And, you know, that reunification was something we talked about often when we could talk. I remember the speculation of when I would be back, because we were never told when we were coming home. Really, we weren't even supposed to tell our loved ones when we were coming home for security reasons. But I remember even when we finally did land back in the States, in New Jersey, we didn't even know how long we're going to be there for before we could get home. And I remember how annoyed Caitlin was, because they were planning a party for me when I came back, and they needed me to be here for it. So that sort of was important. But I never knew, like, I didn't know exactly what day I'd be back. And so, but we couldn't wait for that, because we were at this place that we'd only been married for a year whenever I was deployed. And we were at this place where we thought, like, this is our happy ending. Like, when I come home, everything's going to be great again. I have a few pictures of it, actually, if Julie wants to pull one of those up. But this picture here is when my bus was pulling. And that's actually me standing there with I have a laptop case that I'm carrying. It's hard to see, but that's me on the bus. And you can go to the next one. And there we are for the first time. I don't know what the wind's doing to her hair there. She actually wished that wasn't part of the picture. But I'm very red, holding back tears, I'll be honest with you. She's not holding them back at all. There's one more picture you can show. And there we are. That's our first hug after 15 months apart. That was our first hug. And I remember, and we had a lot of, I probably had one of the largest groups of family there. I don't have a picture of that up here, but there had to be, there were more people there than what's sitting in this room right now, I think, the day that I came back, family and friends that came to see the celebration. I remember my sister was extremely pregnant, and it was that night that she had Maddox. So somehow she was able to hold off having him until the night I came home. I remember getting that text that at like 3 a.m. or something like that, that you were in labor or you had had him. I forget exactly when that happened, but you know, that moment, that elation, that reunification, that moment of finally at last, like the happy ending, right? This extremely difficult time that we went through as a couple, and it wasn't easy. It was very difficult, to be apart for that long. Caitlin, you know, spent a lot of time at home with her parents, staying with them. She split her time often between staying with them and staying in our townhouse in North Huntingdon, PA. But we could not wait for that reunification because we believed that when I came home, the hardest part was over. Right? We believed the hardest part was over once I came home. Because just being apart and the stress of her worrying about whether I was safe or whether I was hurt or in danger, once that was over, we believed that everything was going to be different. But little did we know that the year that followed my return home would be one of the most difficult seasons that we ever experienced in our marriage. That first year coming home from Iraq, and I have not shared this with many people. We've shared it with some. We've been married almost 13 years. It'll be 13 years we've been married this May. And in those 13 years of marriage, the hardest time, the hardest season, the most difficult season in our marriage wasn't when I was deployed. It was that first 6 months to a year after I came home. And you think to yourself, that doesn't make sense. You would think that everything would be better because the reunion was amazing. It was wonderful, but the reunion wasn't reality, right? The reunion wasn't reality. Reality was learning or relearning how to be married after being apart for over a year. You see, when you're apart from someone for that long, things change in your life and in your routine. Caitlin had become much more independent. She was always a pretty independent person, but she became much more independent. There were things that I used to take care of that now she had been doing for over a year now. She had a schedule. She had a routine. She had things that she did. She made decisions a certain way, and it wasn't necessarily the same way that I would do things. And then I had been spending all this time in a military combat zone, living a very specific type of lifestyle, being very regimented, always never having time to really think about anything else other than what I'm doing so that I can come home, right? You're always on this, like, this sense of alert where everything that's going on around you, you're paying attention to because you don't know what the enemy could use against you, right? Laying up bed at night, hearing mortars go off and rockets go off, and you know that this could be the night one lands on me. I didn't know. And so I spent this, and then all of a sudden we come back together and our worlds had been so different for the last year. And now we're like trying to just pick up where we left off. And that was very, very difficult. It was very difficult. We had to learn how to be married again. And, you know, we knew Jesus. We were believers. We loved him. We were serving him. We were serving him in church. But that wasn't helping us. It didn't make it any easier. Well, maybe it did. I shouldn't say didn't make it any easier. Maybe it would have been impossible if it wasn't for Jesus. But it was very difficult. It was very hard. I believe the reason that we struggled for the first year to learn how to be married again was because we didn't plan for what the first 6 months to a year would look like when I came home. We were so fixated on the reunion that we never gave much thought to what life might look like in those first 6 months after I came home, or that first year after I came home. We never planned for it because we had this idea that once we were together again, all of our problems would be solved and everything would be as it should be. We thought that because we loved each other and we loved Jesus, that we will be just fine and that our marriage, in fact, would be better because of our time apart, that our marriage would be better because of what we experienced. And what we found was the exact opposite. And unfortunately, like us, there are people who get married and they have this idea that once they get married, everything is going to be great. Everything is going to be perfect, right? Any problems that we might have in our relationship, marriage is going to solve them. Right? That's sort of the idea that many people have, that if we just get married, everything in the relationship is going to get better. That somehow we are so in love when we get married that is going to be the thing that gets us through those difficult seasons in our marriage. And we don't think that what our marriage will look like. We don't think about what it will look like 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, or further down the road. There's no planning ahead for difficulty because we don't think there's going to be any. We're naive when we first get married. I think most people, and I don't want to speak for every person, but I think most people, maybe you can attest this, when you got married, you weren't thinking about what your life would look like 20 years after you got married. You were thinking about what your life would look like the next day, maybe the next week or two. Maybe you thought a year in advance. I don't know. But most people, that doesn't cross their mind because they think that what they're in love, this is the one. We're going to spend the rest of our lives together, and things are going to go relatively smoothly. Yeah, we might expect some bumps in the road, but we don't think that there's going to be any real difficulty because of how much we mean to one another. Last week, we started our marriage boot camp series, and we talked about knowing your enemy, right? That Satan has made it his mission to destroy my marriage and your marriage. That every marriage out there, Satan has made it his mission to destroy. But knowing the enemy is really only half the battle. You can know who the enemy is, but that's only going to get you so far. You also need to have a plan of attack. You need to have a plan of attack or a battle plan for how you're going to fight back against the enemy of your marriage. You and I need to have a plan in place for what we're going to do when difficulty comes. We can't have this idea that everything will be good because we love each other, because if that was the case, then the divorce rate would not be 50%, because I don't think anybody who gets married, at least in today's culture and in our country, gets married because they have to. They get married because they want to, because they're in love with the person they're marrying. But that is not enough to keep a marriage moving forward and have a marriage thrive. It's not. And we see that being played out in our culture today. No, we need to know who our enemy is, but then we need to plan for attack. We need a battle plan. We need to know what we are going to do. From a military perspective, it would be quite foolish not to plan and train and be prepared for conflict. If we were to just, you know, go about our lives thinking that the world is at peace and that nobody hates us and everything's going to be fine, that would be quite foolish for us. Because no nation's military wants to be surprised when an enemy attacks. We want to be prepared for it. We want to have countermeasures put in place. We want to have a defensive strategy and an offensive strategy. We don't want trouble to come. We don't want conflict to come. But you best be sure that we're going to be prepared in case it does. Any wise nation would approach it that way. It would be foolish to go into battle. I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine? When the Allies were planning out the D-Day invasion, can you imagine if the commanding officers pulled those that they were leading onto those beaches, if they were to pull them together that day and say, listen, we're about to storm this beach. We aren't sure what the objective is. We're not sure where we're going once we get there. And we're not quite sure what we're going to do once we establish what it is that we don't know we're trying to do right now. But we'll figure it out. Good luck. Godspeed. I mean, can you imagine what that would have been like if that was the way that we strategized that? That would be foolish. And anybody in this room probably would think that would be absolutely ridiculous to go into combat with that type of strategy. But that's exactly what we do with our marriages on a regular basis. We get married thinking everything will be great, that everything is going to work out because we're in love. And then when we get attacked by the enemy, when the enemy of our marriage comes and sets his attacks against us, we never develop a plan. So we get defeated. And that's why we have a 50% divorce rate in our country. Because we never planned for the attack. No, we need a plan. You and your spouse need a plan. Me and my spouse need a plan for how we are going to do battle for our marriage. You have got to take this posture within your marriage that this relationship is valuable and precious and that there is someone out there who wants to ruin it. And so it is incumbent upon you and your spouse to come together and develop a plan for how you're going to handle the difficulties of marriage, the difficulties of parenting, the difficulties of life, to handle when you are under some form of attack. You've got to strategize. You've got to have a plan. You should be talking about these things, not just going through life hoping that they don't come. We have a great example of this in the Bible. If you've read the story of Joseph before, you will remember that he was a man with a plan. Joseph was a man who had a strategy and he had a plan. And that plan not only saved his entire family, but it saved an entire nation because he thought enough to plan ahead. Joseph, if you recall, was one of the sons of Jacob. He wasn't known for his subtlety. In fact, some might say that Joseph was on the arrogant side. If you read through his story and you look at the way that he would talk to his brothers, they didn't really care for him too much. He had an arrogance about him, whether intentional or not. It just was part of who he was. And because of that, they didn't like being around him. In fact, his brothers plotted to kill him, but realized they couldn't do that. So they sold him into slavery, right? They got rid of him because they didn't want him around. And so Joseph goes into slavery, but God had a plan for Joseph. And through a series of events that we don't have the time this morning to go into, Joseph eventually finds himself in prison. He's in prison. A number of things happened before that, but for the purpose of today, he finds himself in prison in Egypt. And when he's in this Egyptian prison, he meets two members of Pharaoh's court, if you remember the story. And each of them has a dream. And they're not sure what the dream means. And lucky for them, Joseph just happens to be somebody who God has gifted with the ability to interpret dreams. And so they tell Joseph their dreams. Joseph interprets both of their dreams. And wouldn't you know it, both of those dreams, both of the interpretations come to pass. And so Joseph remains in prison for a little while. And eventually we see in the story that the Pharaoh of Egypt has a dream. In fact, his dream consists of two dreams, really, as we'll see in a moment. And he's perplexed by what these dreams mean. He's asked those in his royal court to try to tell him what those dreams could mean, but none of them are able to do so. And so he is told by the member of his court who had Joseph successfully interpret a dream for him that there was this man named Joseph in prison who could probably interpret this dream. And so Pharaoh sends for Joseph to interpret this dream. And that's where we pick up in our text. In Genesis 41, 14 through 16, it says this. Pharaoh sent for Joseph at once, and he was quickly brought from the prison. After he shaved and changed his clothes, he went in and stood before Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream last night, and no one here can tell me what it means. But I have heard that when you hear about a dream, you can interpret it. It is beyond my power to do this, Joseph replied, but God can tell you what it means and set you at ease. And so Pharaoh then goes on to tell Joseph about this dream that he has. And to kind of condense the story here, essentially, Pharaoh has these two dreams in one. And in one of these dreams, he sees these seven fat cows. Maybe you're familiar with the story, but these seven fat cows who are very healthy looking and they've been eating well. And then all of a sudden, he sees up out of the Euphrates, seven very ugly, scrawny, deathly, sickly-looking cows that look like they could die over at any moment. And then all of a sudden, the sickly, thin cows consume and eat the seven fat cows. But one of the key details in the stream was that even after the seven sick, thin-looking cows ate the fat cows, they didn't look any better. They were still thin and sickly and just looked terrible. And then within the same conversation, he says, and it was like another dream he had where there were seven heads of grain. And these seven heads of grain were lush. They were large. They looked perfect for harvesting. And then there were seven additional heads of grain that were blighted. They were dying. They weren't going to produce any fruit. And the blighted heads of grain consumed the seven healthy looking heads of grain and yet remained blighted. And so Pharaoh explains this to Joseph and he's asking Joseph, what does this mean? These dreams make no sense to me, Joseph. What is going on? And Joseph replies in Genesis 41, 25 through 27, it says, Joseph responded, both of Pharaoh's dreams mean the same thing. God is telling Pharaoh in advance what he is about to do. The seven healthy cows and the seven healthy heads of grain both represent 7 years of prosperity. The seven thin, scrawny cows that came up later and the seven heads of grain withered by the east wind represent 7 years of famine. So Joseph explains this to Pharaoh, that basically a terrible famine is coming. Before it gets here, you're going to have 7 great years, 7 years of bountiful harvest. But after that, 7 years of famine are going to come, and it's going to destroy the land. In fact, it will be so bad that it will be as if the 7 good years never even happened. And so Joseph tells this to Pharaoh, and then Joseph continues on. Not only does he give him the bad news, but he gives him a plan. And this is what it says in Genesis 41, 33 through 36. Therefore, Pharaoh should find an intelligent and wise man and put him in charge of the entire land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh should appoint supervisors over the land and let them collect 1/5 of all the crops during the 7 good years. Have them gather all the food produced in the good years that are just ahead and bring it to Pharaoh's storehouses. Store it away and guard it so there will be food in the cities. That way there will be enough to eat when the 7 years of famine come to the land of Egypt. Otherwise, this famine will destroy the land. And if we would continue reading on, we would find that Pharaoh was extremely impressed with this plan. That in the 7 good years, they were going to prepare for some bad years, right? That they weren't going to wait till the bad years got here to do something about it. They were going to, in the good times, in the bountiful times, when the fruit was plenty, they were going to prepare for when that was no longer the case. They were going to prepare for this famine before it ever got there so that when it came, they would survive it, right? And Pharaoh was so impressed with his plan that he made Joseph the guy that Joseph recommended. He appointed Joseph became second in command of all of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh himself. And the rest of the story is history. It worked. When the famine came, they had enough. And it prevented the entire kingdom from being destroyed. And eventually it brought the reunification of Joseph and his family, and it saved them. And that's for another day. But the point that I want to pull out this morning is that Joseph saw what was coming. He knew that there was this terrible famine was coming. And rather than waiting for it to come to then react to it, he chose to prepare for it when times were good, so that he wouldn't be destroyed by it when it came. He had a plan for the future. This principle applies to our marriages as well. We need to have a plan for when difficulty inevitably will come, whether it's financial difficulty, whether it's difficulty with our children, whether it's communication problems that you have, whether it's relational difficulties, whether there's a health crisis that comes. I mean, you name it, there are a number of things that we can think of that could create difficulty in a relationship. Maybe you have experienced some of those things, but difficulty inevitably comes. And this principle of preparing in the good times for when the bad come is wise. Not waiting until there's a problem, but preparing in advance for one to possibly come in. And so there's two things this morning, if we're talking about big picture here. We're talking about having a plan of action, a battle plan for our marriage. Today, what we're talking about is very big picture, right? It's not specific details. Right? We're going to get to that in a later message. But today, it's about the big picture. There's two big picture ideas that I want to impress upon you this morning, that if we would just implement these into a plan for our marriages, we would find that when trouble comes, and it inevitably will, maybe you're in it right now, right? But when it does come, that there is a way that we can move forward and not allow it to destroy us, okay? Two big picture ideas here. And the first of those two big picture ideas is that we need to begin with the end in mind. We need to begin with the end in mind. Now, that sounds great. I can't take credit for that. There's a book by a man named Stephen Covey. He has since passed. You've probably heard it. It's called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Okay? It was a required reading when I was in grad school. But in that book, he lists these 7 habits of things that he says will make you a highly effective person with regards to whatever you do with your life. And one of those is begin with the end in mind. And it's such a powerful idea that it applies so well to marriages. To begin with the end in mind. Joseph saw the end result of what would happen if nothing was done. Joseph knew what would happen if nothing was done. If they just kept business as usual, and then when the famine came, they would try to deal with it then. He knew that wasn't going to work. He began with the end in mind. Joseph saw the end result that he wanted to see, and that was that they would survive the famine. And his plan was based on what he hoped to see in the future. So he began with the end in mind. That drove his decision making, and our marriages should be no different. I want you to imagine with me for a moment that you're well into your senior years. And I realize that some of you, you're there, but some of us are not. But I want you to imagine you're well into your senior years. Let's say you're 75 and older, okay? 75 and older. And I want you to imagine that the person that you are married to right now is the person that you are going to be sitting with when you're 75 or older. And I want you to imagine that you are at an anniversary party, a wedding anniversary. It's your wedding anniversary, all right? And your children and grandchildren have put together a party for you, a gathering for you to celebrate your marriage because you have been able to make it work for this much time, okay? You're in your later years and you have gone through life. And I want you to imagine whether you're in your 30s today, whether you're in your 60s today, I want you to imagine this in your mind if you can, okay? That you're at this gathering where people are here celebrating your marriage. Of course, your spouse will look a little older than they do today, but their smile is the same. Their laugh is the same. Their quirks that they have are the same. Some of those quirks that you could probably live without are the same. But you've made it to this point anyway in your life by God's grace. You're still alive to see this happen. And so at this anniversary, you have your kids and you have your grandkids. You have your nieces, your nephews, your family and friends are all there to celebrate with you. You receive cards and gifts from people. And each card you open, you see somebody thanking you. Thanking you for showing them what a lasting marriage looks like. Imagine getting cards from your children and your grandchildren thanking you for being an example for them, for demonstrating to them that it really can work, right? Imagine how that would make you feel knowing that because of the work you put into your marriage, you have generations of people who are now looking at your relationship and thanking you for not giving up and thanking you for being an example. I don't know about you, and some of you, you've been there. This has happened to you already. So I'm sure you can relate to this. It has not been, I'm not there yet at my age. And so I would imagine to myself, that would be an incredible feeling, right? To be able to have my life with my wife be such an example to my family. I want you to imagine this is you now, right? And you look out and you see your kids and your spouse and their spouses. Maybe you have grandkids who are married, nieces and nephews, great nieces and nephews who are now married. And they have watched you and your spouse as you have faithfully demonstrated what marriage is supposed to be, a lifelong commitment to one another. Think about the legacy that will be. And I want you to ask yourself if that is what you want for your future. If that is what you want for the future of your kids and for your grandkids. I don't know any married couple who would say, nah, it doesn't really float my boat. I don't know that that's really what I want. I think anybody who's married today or who's getting married today would think to themselves, that would be a pretty incredible experience. That I can picture it in my mind, what that might be like. Maybe you've made mistakes in your past. Maybe your family saw those mistakes that you made in your marriage in the past. But the beauty of the gospel is that you don't have to be ashamed of those mistakes. You don't have to be ashamed of your past. You don't have to carry the guilt of that with you any longer. You can be forgiven. But you also don't have to repeat those same mistakes. And that is the key. Many have made mistakes in their relationships and their marriages, and they didn't work out. Maybe you're on a second marriage or a remarriage. You don't have to make the same mistakes we made the first time around. That's the beauty of the gospel. Because it means forgiveness for all who would receive it and the ability to live a transformed life. And that includes a transformed marriage, if we want it. All of us want to leave a legacy that outlives us. My hope is that my marriage leaves a legacy that impacts my great-grandchildren, my great-great-grandchildren, people I will never meet this side of eternity. I hope that someday the decisions that Caitlin and I make will have an impact on a generation of people that I will never meet until they get to heaven and join me someday. That should motivate every single person in this room. But if all I focus on is the here and now, if all I plan for is the immediate future, then I will not be prepared when difficulty in my marriage presents itself. When I came home from Iraq, we weren't prepared for the difficulty that we would face. And it was hard. And by God's grace and our willingness to be humble and recognize that we didn't have all the answers, he got us through that season. And our marriage is stronger now than it's ever been. But if all we do is focus on the here and now, we won't be prepared. And maybe you won't make it through that difficult stage. No, we need to begin with the end in mind. I need to look at where I want to be in my marriage on my 50th anniversary if God so chooses to let me live long enough to experience one. And you should have the same mindset. We need to be determined to get there. By beginning with the end in mind, we need to look at what we want to see in the future in our marriage, the legacy we want to leave, and then we need to be determined to take whatever steps are necessary to get there. But if you don't begin with the end in mind, if you don't think of what you want to see at the end of this thing we call life, then you're never going to make the specific steps necessary to ensure that you get to that end. You're always going to be reacting to life, not being prepared for it. Joseph knew the famine was coming, and he didn't just sit back and enjoy the 7 good years and give no thought to the trouble that awaited him. We know that we have an enemy who wants to destroy our marriages, and we can choose to enjoy the good times while they last without preparing for the difficulty, but then when it comes, we won't be prepared to endure it. We won't. This leads me to the second big idea. So the first is beginning with the end in mind. The second is this leads to the second component of the plan is we begin with the end in mind and then we proactively prepare for difficulty, right? We begin with the end in mind and we proactively prepare for difficulty. You can't be proactive if you aren't thinking about the future, right? You can't be. Being proactive is the opposite of being reactive, right? To be reactive is a situation comes, then I respond to it, right? Tragedy comes, I react to it. Difficulty comes, I react to it. Being proactive is saying, tragedy hasn't hit yet. Difficulty hasn't hit yet, but I'm going to put some things in place so that when it does come, we're okay. If you're never thinking about the end, beginning with the end in mind, you can't be proactive. At least not the way that we need to be. And so that this second big idea, it flows right after out of the first, to proactively prepare. Most of us are reactive in nature. We don't want to change anything until we have to, right? We don't want to change anything until we have to. We call things preventative maintenance for a reason, right? Preventative maintenance. You've heard the term before. We routinely change the oil in our vehicles. Why do we do that? Is it because there's a problem? No. If you're waiting to change the oil in your vehicle until the engine explodes, you've got a problem. We change the oil regularly so that the engine keeps working the way it's supposed to. It's preventative maintenance. We don't want sludge to build up. We don't want to burn so much oil that the engine runs out. Caitlin could tell you a little bit about that. You have to ask her. But we do these things preventatively, right? To prevent things bad from happening, right? That's why we call it preventative maintenance. We would call someone a fool if they never changed the oil or checked their oil level. If we had the idea that as long as the key turns it on and when I hit the gas, it goes forward, and when I hit the brake, it stops, and I can get from here to there, then everything's fine, right? If that's the mentality that we have, and we never did anything else with those vehicles, we would call that person a fool, right? Because then when something catastrophic happens, what could have been easily avoided by just doing some basic preventative, proactive things, now we have a situation that's going to cost us thousands of dollars. And maybe you won't have the money to fix it, so now you're down a vehicle that you depended on. And now things are even more difficult for you. All because we didn't take the necessary preventative, proactive steps to try to stop that from happening, right? We would say anybody that does that really isn't using a lot of wisdom. So then if that's the case, if we do preventative maintenance because we want to prevent a problem, then why is it that we're more willing to do that with our car, but not with the single most important human relationship that we will ever have in this life? Why are we more willing to do maintenance on a car than we are the single most important human relationship in this life, our marriage. We have people that are, they are more quick to do those things with a vehicle than they are with their own marriage. It boggles my mind. I don't understand it. By being proactive, Joseph prevented the starvation and death of an entire nation. It was good. It was in the good years that he planned for the bad ones. Had he waited for the bad years to start doing something about the famine, it would have been too late. For a long time, there has been such a stigma in the Christian community when it comes to marriage counseling. You know, marriage counseling is only for people who are really at the brink of the end, right? They're at the brink of their marriage. They're about to divorce. People who go to marriage counseling, they've got real problems. And in the Christian community, it's even worse because we have this idea that, well, if you're a believer, you shouldn't have trouble in your marriage, right? If you know Jesus, then everything should be great. Are you reading your Bible enough? Are you praying enough? Well, then you must not be if you're having difficulty in your marriage. That is the mentality that unfortunately so many have had. And I'm grateful to see that that mentality is changing. The stigma is changing because there's a new generation of Christians who have watched the generations who've come before us whose marriages, even in the Christian community, have failed. Because of this stigma behind working on your marriage and having, whether it's counseling or going to a conference or reading books together, doing something preventative. But why do we wait for counseling until there's a problem? Why do we do that? Why do we wait until there's a problem? That's like waiting for your engine to blow up before you put oil in it. But we do that with our marriages all the time. We wait until there's a problem before we ever reach out for help, before we ever go to counseling, before we ever read a book on something, before we ever ask our brothers and sisters in Christ to pray for us. We wait until there's a problem, then we decide we're going to do something about it. Or, like most people, we become so stubborn and set in our ways and unwilling to admit that maybe we don't have all the answers that we won't ever ask for help in our marriages either. Destroyed and it ends in divorce, or we live a very miserable existence until one of us dies. That sounds harsh, but that's the reality for many people, even Christians. Many of us went through premarital counseling before we got married, and that's great. I've done a couple of weddings, and in the ones that I've done, I have required premarital counseling. I will not do a wedding unless they go through 8 sessions of premarital counseling with me. Now, there's some different, you know, some do 4, some do 10. I do 8 sessions, right? Minimum 8 sessions of premarital counseling. And I do that because I believe that that is one of the single most important factors in the success of a marriage is how that counseling goes. Studies show that couples who go through premarital counseling are 30% less likely to get divorced. You can't argue with the numbers. So you better believe that if I'm going to do premarital counseling, I'm going to put everything I have into it because I want to see that marriage succeed. So we do that, right? And then we get married, and there's no follow-up. We never go to another counseling session again. We say you need it before you get married, but once you're married, you've got it all figured out. Good luck, right? That's how we do things. And it makes no sense to me. But we've got to be proactive. We can't have this idea that everything's going great, because usually one person is a little bit more oblivious to the challenges than the other person. And usually it's us guys, right? We're a little bit more oblivious, right? But we got to be proactive. We've got to plan for struggles. We have to do this. If you don't have a battle plan, if you're not beginning with the end in mind, if you're not being proactive in preparing for difficulty, then when it comes, when the enemy comes and he attacks, and we've already established he's going to attack, then you are not going to be prepared. And many will not be able to stand under it. Their marriage will fail. And so I'm encouraging all of you this morning, whether you've been married for 5 years, whether you've been married for 50 years, and I don't know, or in between, I don't know how long everyone here has been married. But I encourage you that if you've never had conversations like this, have them. It's not too late to develop a plan. So we begin with the end in mind. We be proactive in our marriages. And I really, this morning, just I encourage you to consider what I've shared with you. Don't leave here thinking you don't need this. Don't leave here thinking that you're above this. Don't leave here thinking that everything is great because oftentimes it's when it's those who think they're the safest, those who think they don't need this, that don't see the enemy whenever they launch their attack. Those who think they're the safest don't see the enemy when they attack. If our spouses mean as much to us as we say that they did when we exchanged our vows on our wedding day, then they deserve the same kind of attention and forethought that this kind of planning requires. If your spouse means as much to you as they did the day you got married, then you owe it to them to put some of this into practice. Wouldn't you rather be prepared for difficulty? I would rather plan for a difficulty that never comes than to face a difficulty and never plan for it. Wouldn't you?